Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America at this moment.
Welcome back to another episode of Crim Law Presents CAF Chats. I'm Major Ultimus, and today we will be discussing the CAF decision in United States versus Patterson and Air Force case. Today I'm joined by two first-time podcasters, Lieutenant Colonel Scaletti and intern Jackson Trout. Lieutenant Colonel Scaletti is the new chair of the ADC department at T. Jaglis, and Jackson is a rising 2L summer intern. Sir, would you please introduce yourself?
Sure. For those of you who know me, you already know me. For those of you who don't, my criminal law background includes an old-fashioned BCT trial counsel, an old-fashioned senior trial counsel at 4ID. I was a BJA, which has some criminal law stuff to it. And then I was an SVP, a military magistrate. I was the chief commissioner of ACCA. I was the senior defense counsel at Fort Riley, and I was the regional defense counsel for the Seventh Circuit in the Pacific most recently. So back-to-back TDS, four straight years of TDS, without ever having the intent of going to TDS, but I loved it there. So that's who I am. Happy to be here.
Thank you, sir. And Jackson, you are a rising 2L at UVA Law School. Can you tell us how your summer's been here at T. Jaglis?
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. It's been fantastic. I think the Jag School's a really kind of interesting and unique place to spend a summer at. It's a really great atmosphere and a really great opportunity to kind of see all the different fields of law that Jags get to work in. And it's been a really great time getting exposed to what all you do.
I think it goes without saying your favorite was in crim law.
That's why I'm here.
Thanks, Jackson. Will you tell us the procedural history and facts concerning U.S. v. Patterson?
Yeah, absolutely. So the appellee was convicted of a series of offenses from 2008 to 2019 against three victims: the appellee's former wife, the appellee's stepdaughter, referred to as CH, and the stepdaughter's close friend. The issue at hand is the appellee's conviction for rape of a child, CH, in violation of Article 120B of the UCMJ. The specification alleged that the rape was committed between on or about 1 October 2015 and on or about 30 November 2015. During trial, CH testified that during a night in, quote, roughly spring/summer of 2015, the appellee offered CH several beers that she drank. CH proceeded to feel hot and dizzy and lay down on a couch to close her eyes. Appellee then turned off the light, got on top of CH, and engaged in penetrative sex. CH was 12 when this occurred. At trial, CH could not recall when exactly the incident occurred outside of it happening during the spring or summer of 2015. During her testimony at trial, CH stated that she remembered the weather was not cold and was, quote, good for t-shirts and basketball shorts. She also stated that she knew the event was during 2015 because it was while her mom was still pregnant with her younger brother and that her mother was probably 5 or 6 months pregnant when the incident occurred. The government presented no evidence that the incident occurred between October and November of 2015 and even acknowledged during closing the discrepancy between the evidence presented at trial and the dates on the charge sheet. Despite this, the government never sought to amend the specification or request instructions on findings by exceptions and substitutions. On appeal, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, AFCA, set aside the finding of guilt of rape of a child and concluded that the evidence was factually insufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the incident occurred between on or about 1 October 2015 and on or about 30 November 2015. The Air Force TJAG certified the case to CAF to answer the question of whether, when time was not an essential element of the offense, AFCA erred in finding factual insufficiency based on the discrepancy between the date pleaded and the date proved. CAF ultimately said no and affirmed the AFCA decision, holding that they did not have the authority to review AFCA's findings of factual insufficiency.
Thanks, Jackson. Sir, we see in this case that the old version of Article 67 was applied here based on the dates of the offenses. Can you talk briefly about what the difference between the 2018 Article 67 was?
Yeah, so the previous version of Article 67, CAF had the authority to review a lower court's determination of factual sufficiency only for matters of law and proper application of legal principles, which you'll talk about a little later with regard to like proximate cause and things like that. So they're talking about specific legal principles that are improperly applied during a factual sufficiency review. Now, they weren't able to reassess those lower court's fact-finding at the time. And 67 gives him a little bit, the new version gives him a little bit more leeway in that regard.
Sir, what's the takeaway for the field on this?
So the takeaway is just understanding which law applies and, you know, which world you're living in. So with all the changes that we've seen over the UCMJ over the years, it's always important to understand which version of which statute we're applying at what time. So in this particular case, it had a pretty big impact because it could have changed the outcome, could have changed the holding. So this one, in future cases, they may not use this as precedent if they're applying a different version of the statute.
Thank you, sir. And so since CAF ultimately said that they did not have the authority to review the finding of AFCA's factual insufficiency, CAF distinguished this case from two other CAF opinions regarding variance. Jackson, would you tell us about the first case?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, ma'am. So the first case that they talk about is United States v. Hunt. In Hunt, CAF affirmed the lower court's finding of guilt and granting of a variance for the charge date range where the evidence showed the offense actually occurred a few weeks earlier than the charge date range. This is distinguishable from Patterson because the lower court affirmed the finding of guilt in Hunt. In contrast here, CAF is dealing with a lower court that had overturned the finding of guilt and denied granting a variance. This difference, CAF argues, raises a question of CAF's authority to review matters of factual sufficiency and their power to disturb lower courts' rulings of factual insufficiency.
CAF further discussed Thompson, a case where CAF remanded a lower review court's ruling based on their incorrect application of legal principles as authority for CAF to take action and remand the lower court's opinion here. CAF again distinguishes Thompson from this case at hand because the lower judicial body in Thompson came to its factual insufficiency ruling through misapplied legal principles. Here in Patterson, CAF did not find that AFCA misapplied any legal principles to come to its factual insufficiency ruling. While the government argues that this is a case of misapplied law and that AFCA treated the date of an offense like a required element and failed to apply a variance analysis, CAF is not convinced by this. CAF holds that AFCA set aside that finding of guilt because they were not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of the factual sufficiency. This ruling was well within AFCA's discretion, and CAF held that they did not have the authority to disturb that ruling. AFCA found that the incident in this case in Patterson likely occurred in June 2015, at least 3 months before the date alleged in the specification. Jackson, how did AFCA define what on or about means?
Yeah, so AFCA cited to U.S. v. Simmons, where CAF found on or about to mean a date range of a few days to weeks.
So as we know in this charge, it's 1 October, and CAF doesn't extend it to that, correct?
No, they do not.
So for takeaways from the field, sir, what are your thoughts?
So on this case in particular, I think that a lot of trial practitioners have kind of a misunderstanding of what variance is. If you don't ask the court for something, then you don't get it. This, and a little preview for next week or next whenever we do it, we have the trial counsel and the defense counsel are telling the court, the higher courts, what they're thinking. And so when you get into what they're thinking, they're aware of legal issues. They're demonstrating their understanding of those legal issues. The best example in this case is that the trial counsel argued specifically, but then didn't ask for a variance instruction or findings of exceptions and substitutions or any type of remedy. They didn't use RCM 603 or 604 to try and fix the problem, but they did tell the court, we knew of it and we just rolled. And that's the takeaway for the field is, don't do that. When you know there's a legal issue, address it.
So, sir, talking a little bit about those, we don't get necessarily how far of a variance can go or how far of a date range you can have. So we knew, based on CH's testimony, that the incident occurred when her mother was pregnant, and we know that's 9 to 10 months. Do you think that range would have been okay?
You know, it's tough to tell. But you're shifting into a land of, now you're not talking about factual sufficiency. Now you're talking about, did the judge abuse his discretion in giving a certain type of instruction? And that's a whole different ballgame. So, you know, it's much less likely that we would have ever read about this.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And CAF also addressed the all too common instance where the understanding of the evidence changes after a specification has been drafted. This can happen, as we have all seen. However, there are avenues the government could have used to address this misunderstanding. You talked briefly about 603 and 604. Will you just talk a little bit more about that?
So 604 allows them to withdraw and re-prefer if there's going to be a major change and the defense objects. You know, in practicality, sometimes the defense just, and in this case, they probably would have, based on what I've read about the case, that they would have just agreed to a major change and you wouldn't have to go through the whole rigmarole of changing everything. So 603 is what discusses whether you're doing a major or minor change. If it's considered a minor change, then you can go ahead and do that over the defense's objection. The important point there is that you're fixing this at trial. You're fighting this battle in an Article 39A session or an 802 where you come together and you fix this problem then. And that's why CAF spends an entire paragraph at the end of the opinion saying, hey guys, you could have fixed this. And you kind of get that that's the point of this opinion.
Yes, sir. And we talked a little bit about the interviewing of witnesses, potentially more than once. It seems that the government was aware that this testimony was going to be different than the charge offense. Of the available options we discussed, what advice would you give to the field when dealing with a change in evidence after the specification has been drafted?
So the first thing is having a good relationship between the parties. So if you spend time developing the relationship between the trial counsel and the defense counsel, then you can have a recess conversation. And that's probably the easiest way to solve an issue like this. Recess conversation where you figure out which parties want. You don't expect anyone to do anything specific, especially with regard to defense counsel and their clients. But you might be able to agree to something. If you'll read in the first footnote of this case that there's a lot of other things going on. So maybe the defense counsel is like, hey, this one specification that was inartfully drafted, no big deal. We'll just agree to a major change. Or maybe the government says, oh, you know, that one specification isn't super important to us getting through this case. So they either withdraw it and figure it out later. But that conversation happens first. And then you decide whether or not, if you can't solve it that way, you just say, hey, military judge, we are asking for a specific instruction. And then you force the judge to make a call on the record about whether or not they're going to give a specific instruction. And then it completely changes the landscape of the appellate process.
Yes, sir. And I think the main takeaway that I think you've said a few times is you just can't do nothing.
Right. Exactly. You can't tell everybody, I know what's going on. And then you're like, big gulps, huh? See you later.
Thank you both for this discussion. Jackson, it was wonderful having you with us this summer, and we wish you the best of luck in your second year of law school. Please tune in to the next episode of Crim Law Presents CAF Chats.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.